Well, hello, everybody. I am Captain Jeff Monroe of the International Association of Maritime Port Executives, and I'm here with my co-host and distinguished colleague, Amy Andres, who is the Executive Director of the Inland Rivers Ports and Terminal Association. Hi, Amy. Happy New
Hey,
Year.
Captain, Happy New Year to you.
It's been an exciting year, hasn't it? And I think it's about to get a lot more exciting as we start thinking about what's happening with the new administration coming in and the old administration going out. And like always, I was a bit disappointed that the Biden administration did not take up a comprehensive transportation plan that looked at all of the aspects of roadways, runways, railways, and ports, including the inland rivers. So it's been kind of an interesting 4 years, and now we've got the next session to look forward to. So what do you think the big change is going to be, Amy?
Well, certainly, I think it's very exciting. So we're joining our listeners, episode one, season three, episode one of Doc Talk. We're actually joining you the day after
The inauguration.
Day after inauguration. So it's so very exciting. When we talk about the new administration, I'm calling it the new but returning administration, right? So yes, we've just gotten done with 4 years under President Joe Biden. We're leading into four more years under President Donald Trump. We've had a little bit of a sneak peek of what this next 4 years is going to be. So I'm excited to jump into all of it with you.
Yeah, I think it is going to be interesting. And despite the fact that I'm not necessarily sure we're going to be taking over Greenland or the Panama Canal, right? I think the reality is the things that tend to we get focused on in our industry and stuff like that. And I think probably the biggest thing is going to be the grant funding and what's going to happen with all that. There's a big kick for obviously reducing the deficit and everything like that. And I think ultimately there's a lot of stuff on the table right now.
Absolutely. And we want to take a look at some of the successes under Biden. We don't want to just skip right past that, right? So we had the infrastructure, the IIJA, the Investment Infrastructure Jobs Act, the BIL, and more. Those just $1 trillion worth of infrastructure investments, right? And so under the Biden administration, that was a huge success. Congratulations, Joe Biden, on that. In regards to that, here we are in 2025, we have two more years of that spending from those bills. So in 2025 and 2026, there's billions of dollars coming out. Notice of funding opportunities are being released as we speak. We've already seen the Port Infrastructure Development Program notice of funding opportunity be released. And so we're so excited to see at least two more years of infrastructure investment that we know of, right? We hope that President Trump will pass some type of infrastructure bill himself, also investing into our ports, our bridges, our roadways, and rail infrastructure as well. But again, I just wanted to kind of hit on that is at definitely one of the successes that we saw from Biden that we would love to encourage our new yet returning administration to look at as well.
I think, there was a great advantage that 20% of the PDIP was dedicated toward the smaller ports. And I know a lot of them took advantage of that. And it was much needed money for investment and everything. And I think my biggest disappointment, which has been my disappointment, not only with the last administration, but when President Trump was there beforehand, and before him, Obama and Clinton and Reagan and all the rest of them all the way back, was, the last time we had a comprehensive transportation policy in this country was when Harry Truman was president, which I know, you weren't even born yet.
I don't remember those days.
But, the fact of the matter is that, even with all of the issues we faced during COVID, and all the task force and the committees that got put together, nothing really changed.
So let's hit on some of the funding levels, the infrastructure spending levels. Primarily, the federal agency spending levels Have been successful with the Army Corps of Engineers, the US Coast Guard, Department of Transportation, et cetera. And we want to see that continue. I am encouraged by this new yet returning administration that they will continue the focus and the priority on federal agency spending for overall national infrastructure health, right? I will say I am a bit concerned where the emphasis on the value of private-public partnerships during the first 4 years of the President Trump administration was great. I am a little concerned that we're going to go back to a heavier, if not the same, but heavier emphasis on private-public partnerships. So as we look at what a P3 or a successful P3 model is, I want to encourage our industry, our listeners, to maybe redefine what we expect from a P3 model. Private investment into public infrastructure has historically been the model that we've been using, but I would love for everybody to consider what does private operation of public infrastructure look like? I say that specifically because, again, I'm going to hit on the U.S. Coast Guard. The U.S. Coast Guard is essentially the waterways' highway patrol department, right? They mark our safe channel. They build the roadway signs and place the aids to navigation that our mariners use to successfully and safely navigate our waterway system. Unfortunately, the U.S. Coast Guard's budget is in decline. The levels of workforce are in decline. So we need to either look at increasing the workforce capacity, increasing the levels of spending, or redetermine, reevaluate, redefine how that public agency is marking a public infrastructure asset. Does that make sense?
It does. But I think, the reality in all of this is that one of the things that President Trump has been focused on, obviously, is the immigration crisis. And I think that being part of DHS, we're going to see more funds flowing into the DHS. I think part of the issue, though, has been this, not only with the Coast Guard, but with the Merchant Marine and with the military, is the fact that a lot of young people are not interested in going into the Coast Guard, going into the Merchant Marine, going into the military. And I think that there's an image of issue somewhere that the fact of the matter is that we've got to get much more proactive in introducing younger generations to the type of work that we've been engaged in and getting them interested and helping them to recognize that this is a very valid career. And one of the things that I made in my predictions for up and coming was that, we had issues with the longshoremen, which have been settled, and issues with the maritime industry that, are still ongoing. And the fact of the matter is that one of the things that MARAD can focus on is really getting the word out on recruitment for people for in our industry. We got to get them off of deep water boats too. They really
Yeah,
got to get focused
exactly.
on the inland rivers.
And I'm so glad that you mentioned that because pretty soon in the next week or two, we are coming out with a bonus episode of Doc Talk of the podcast that focuses on just this topic. It's We Work the Waterways. Inland Rivers, Ports, and Terminals has a We Work the Waterways program, an outreach program, 501c3 organization that is doing just this. It's getting out into the high schools and it's trying to attract the high school students into the maritime industry, including the U.S. Coast Guard. And here in a couple of weeks, one of our programs is doing the New Orleans Maritime Academy, the NOMA Academy, to help recruit some of these students into the U.S. Coast Guard. So yes, you're absolutely right. We have a recruiting issue and we have a retention issue. But the fact is that there is an issue. And what we're facing right now is that the U.S. Coast Guard is actually slated to remove assets, aids to navigations, personnel, and assets on some of our river systems in March. So this is happening. If you didn't know, this is happening in March. And so we don't have time to get out there before March and start recruiting and get some of the personnel that they need out to reverse the decision of the removal of assets. So what we have to do is we have to look at a different type of resource. We have to be able to safely navigate these river systems. If we close down the rivers for navigation by not marking the channel, can the barge lines get the insurance that would allow them to transit? Probably not. So if you go and you remove the asset, you're choking off a freight transportation route and you're putting more heavy emphasis on the need for rail and surface transportation. And we're already congested on both of those. So we have to do something as an industry. Does that mean we look at a different way to operate? I know that there are other private organizations such as Rose Point and others that are providing navigation services. Is that the path forward? Is that the redefining of a private service providing public access?
I think a lot of that is going to depend on what we see coming out in the revised radio navigation plan for the United States, because technology has improved dramatically since the days when I went to sea and had to had to use a sextant, and things like that. And I have found that in many ways, physical aids to navigation are much more problematic and much more expensive to maintain. And they have done some tests, obviously. They did a test in Tampa Bay where they eliminated buoys and put virtual buoys in and stuff like that. But we found that on the Inland River system in particular, right, that electronic navigation, particularly if they put in the new differential corrections through the ELORAN system, if ELORAN comes in place, I personally would rather see an investment in that on the Inland Rivers than I would want to see, buoys and stuff like that, because as well as I do, the river system changes dramatically. All right. And the best way to do it is to have means of monitoring what's happening with the system and then putting that into a database that can be readily accessed by the people who are navigating the vessels. And
That's exactly right. Readily accessed, right? So you have your Army Corps of Engineers who determines the sailing line, but if they don't communicate in real time what that safe sailing line is, you run the risk of running aground and you're perhaps even maybe running the risk of a spill, right? So if you have a barge line that's moving some crude oil and you're depending on a sailing line that is a printed document that was maybe produced months ago before a spring flood season happened that is no longer the sailing line. That's a problem. We have to have the ability to communicate in real time what these safe sailing lines are.
Well, I think in the long run that, this modern technology with ECDIS systems and stuff, for the most part, I was on NAVSEC when we, in essence, determined that paper charts were no longer necessary, and, the industry made its transition. My big fear is something that you mentioned earlier on, is where you have private organizations that are trying to fill the gap. That these are non-public organizations, commercial entities that are coming up with river systems and coming up with charting systems and everything, when it really needs to be led by the government, right? And that's what happened on the deep water side. You had all these companies who were producing charts and equipment and everything and doing it in electronic formats. And then the ECDIS, International ECDIS system got approved, right? And then all of a sudden, all these companies went out of business, right? And everybody had to convert their systems over. So if we had a system that was pushed by the government, and that's something I think one of the major focuses is making sure that's included in the radio navigation plan for the United States.
So I'm going to push back on that just a bit because I hear you, and to the utmost extent that I can, I agree with you that this should be a federal responsibility to provide the public service to public infrastructure. However, if they can't, or if they're mismanaging the funds, don't have the capability or cannot provide the service, that doesn't mean that the asset should be shut down and removed and no longer available. What that does mean is that we must look at alternative ways. Now, if we look at just for example, the Army Corps of Engineers and the infrastructure investments, the construction and the maintenance of our locks and dams. There is a portal in place, an avenue to allow private companies to come in and contract with the Army Corps of Engineers to perform the work. Again, we're going back to the IIJA, where there was tons of money, billions of dollars flooded into the system to repair, to upgrade, and maintain our locks and dams. But the Army Corps of Engineers didn't have the in-house capacity to perform all of those projects to completion. So they actually went out for bid to private agencies. That's all I'm saying here.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with that, Amy.
Function, but if they can't perform the function, it shouldn't be shut down. We should be looking for alternative ways.
Yeah, I think as long as it's coming out of the federal government and contracted out to the private sector, that's fine. Right. What I'm more concerned about is when the private sector gets ahead of the federal government, develops a system, right, and tries to make that system sort of the standard by which people will use. And that's where it becomes problematic. As long as the federal government is behind it, I think that works effectively, you know, because then they can contract out because they will set the standard for which navigation.
So my second point to my, and it's maybe my second concern, if you will, in regards to the emphasis and the value placed on P3s is, you know, again, I'm going to restate it, private investment into public infrastructure, private investment. And I keep saying that because we want to wrap our head around it. In administrations past, the idea of tolls is being introduced. If a toll transits through a lock system, we could potentially charge a fee for them to do that. And that tolling mechanism is going to redirect traffic to a cheaper way of doing business, or a cheaper, maybe it's a geographical location where you don't have to transit through the lock system. So I am concerned that if we are putting a higher emphasis on P3s, that we will look at tolling, and I'm absolutely against it.
Well, P3s are very appropriate for right things. And I understand about the investment of private sector into the public infrastructure. The big issue that I've faced with P3s that I've seen is, number one, you know, for whatever investment they want to make from the private sector, you know, they want control over something for many, many, many years, which is, of course, inappropriate. But I think in the long run that, for example, let's use Tampa, for example. Right. When Ports America developed Tampa, right, they came in, they invested in the cranes and everything, equipment and everything, which was great. But, you know, still the responsibility of the port, they had to deal with the hard infrastructure and everything. When you're dealing with a P3 that's doing something like that, and they have to have skin in the game, there's no shortage of people who are willing to come into a public sector and say, hey, look, why don't you guys do this with your money, and then we'll see if we'll participate. That's not the way it needs to work, right? But I think there are appropriate places where private investment in the public sector works, but not necessarily hard infrastructure, all right? Maybe some, you know, it stretches out the public dollars a lot more for the appropriate thing. But I certainly agree with you on things like locks and dams and stuff like that. That to me doesn't seem like it makes a lot of sense to do it that way. But if we're talking about a lot of the infrastructure that people are hoping to develop along the river system, I think that works very effectively as well. And as we're seeing now in the industry, there's a fair amount of bulk cargo demand worldwide. And one of the things that I keep thinking about here is, despite all the you know, pronunciations that are being made by the new administration coming in and stuff like that. The reality, I think, it's going to be more driven by what's happening with global economies. All right, and that's going to have a direct impact certainly on the inland rivers, because one of the things that I see is that there are a lot of commodities that demands are going to be very strong for that are all produced along the inland river system. Right, we know there's going to be some fluctuations in grain and soybeans and crude oil and things like that. But your system remains relatively strong in the export market.
So I was just going to ask you, which commodities, take your crystal ball out and tell me which commodities are going to be on the rise for our export? What are we increasing our exports in?
Well, certainly sorghum, because I discovered that we're one of the largest producers of sorghum in the world. Right. And the biggest consumer of sorghum is China. All right. So that's not going to be necessarily affected. Crude oil, we recognize that we're producing a huge amount of crude oil. And the big issue with crude oil is that we can't refine our own crude oil in many cases. Right. You know, everybody talks about energy independence in the United States. Right. Well, yeah, we produce a huge amount of oil and gas, and that's going to continue, particularly under this new administration. In fact, I'm anticipating it's going to increase. But until the regulations are changed that allow people and companies to come in, redevelop their refineries to accommodate, you know, the lighter fracking oil and the gas and everything that's produced, Right, we're going to continue to export as much as we're importing because we're bringing in a lot of oil from other parts of the world that's heavier crude, right? That's sour crude, right? In essence, we can refine that very effectively. But if we're going to rebuild our infrastructure, if we're going to rebuild our refineries to accommodate our own oil, right? Well, now that triggers all these new regulations, which I'm also hopeful about too, because I'm hoping the next administration will lighten up on that a little bit, particularly, when it comes to dealing with your infrastructure, on the locks and dams and stuff. Look how long it takes to just get through a permitting process, and it's very problematic. I also think we're gonna see an increase in the amount of coal going out again, right? I think that's gonna be back on the table, particularly the metallurgical coal, for production of steel and everything, which a lot of it's been going to South America. I think we're going to have a proliferation of empties, which are going to give your folks an opportunity to repack containers and everything with agricultural cargoes, right? And the thing that I've seen that despite what's been happening in the Red Sea, the container freight rates have stabilized. They're kicking right now. The worldwide rate is less than $4,000, and it's been that way for a multitude of weeks. So I think that's going to continue as well. So I see a lot of those type of commodities, agri-cargos, natural minerals, oils, and certainly soybeans and things like that. I think it's going to remain steady, if not get stronger. Not by leaps and bounds, but it will get stronger.
All commodities that the Inland River system is just well suited to transport for them. So I'm glad to hear you say that.
Absolutely. And of course, I've never been wrong before.
Nice. I want to hit on tariffs, and I gotta lean completely on you for this. There's a lot of conversation and concern right now about the proposed tariffs with this new slash returning administration. What are your thoughts?
Well, tariffs are kind of like the old thing when your father used to say to you, if you do that, I'm coming down there and spanking you, right? And how many times did we really get spanked? The whole aspect of tariffs, it's a very good ploy in the aspect of getting people to pay attention to it. But ultimately, it costs the consumer a lot more because those tariff fees that are applied to that operation, right, or whatever cargo is being imported and stuff like that is eventually going to get passed to the consumer. So I don't necessarily think tariffs are a good thing. They are in maybe some cases. Tariffs benefit very specific industries. All right. So, for example, a number of years ago, they put tariffs on washing machines, right? And the thing is that really boosted the washing machine business and the manufacturing of that, right? But it really didn't do anything much, for the consumer. It just raised the prices up. And of course, if you buy a washing machine, you got to buy a dryer, right? Well, the thing is that they matched the market rate, even though the dryers were being produced domestically, they matched the rate to there. So I don't necessarily think tariffs are a good thing. I think free trade is the best, most effective tool we can. And I think there may be other ways to limit what goes on. But the supply chain now, as a result of COVID, as a result of what's happened beforehand, and now what has happened after this with the change administrations, we're seeing a lot of onshoring, nearshoring products being manufactured, things that are moving from other parts of the world that are coming back to the United States. I think that can effectively happen because of interruptions in the transportation system. And I don't necessarily think tariffs are the best thing. I think incentives to have people switch manufacturing back to the United States, right, and to put those plants here in place. I certainly think any aspect of putting tariffs on Canadians or New Mexicans, there's so much manufacturing going there. I don't see that as a very positive thing, right? And I'm not a big fan necessarily of tariffs at all, only in that, as I say, the cost gets passed along to the consumer, right? And I think that'll be it. Now, of course, it impact exports, but the problem is it's a tit for tat. If we put tariffs on Chinese commodities coming in, well, guess what the Chinese are going to do, right? The exact same things, which will make it more expensive for their people, right? But it'll also deaden the demand for our own products, and that's something that we have to be cautious of. So, it is a type of tool that politicians can use to say, if you don't do this, we're going to do that. But I'm hoping they don't.
So the real reason that he wanted to do the tariffs or implement tariffs is what? What
is fundamentally to shift manufacturing back to the United States, right? Make us less dependent on other countries, which I think in many cases is appropriate, right? A lot of our, medicines come in from China and places like that, and there are quality control issues, and of course technology that comes in as well. So I think the reality in all of this is that if we can manufacture those materials here more effectively in the United States, and of course the first thing everybody says, well, if you manufacture in the United States, you're going to be paying more salaries, so that's going to make the cost higher. Well, take the cheaper commodity that's made overseas and then add all of the transportation costs to it, and guess what? You're in the same place again. So it's really the market that dictates the final cost of what it is. I'd love to see more manufacturing in the United States, but I think it needs to be done through incentives that the states can put in place better than the federal government in most cases. And I think, tariffs always make everybody nervous. Right, but my prediction here is that he's not going to be swinging that stick too hard. I'm hoping it's more threat than it is actuality.
Now, could the argument be made, though, that the increased cost to the consumer due to the tariffs maybe is a wash as compared to the cost of rising prices due to the inflation under the current policies and regulations?
Well, you have to remember that inflation has come down, and it'll go back up, and it'll come back down, and go back up, come back down. I think that the whole aspect of tariffs is that it's a popular political ploy to encourage support at the political level, because it says, well, by putting tariffs in place, it's going to create more jobs domestically. Well, the fact of the matter is that we don't have the capacity that we really need to step up to the plate. It'll take years to get there. All right, so tariffs may in the short run may have an impact, but it's not going to have an impact by replacing domestic production with international production.
So we don't have the capacity currently, but especially for all of our listeners, I would be remiss if I didn't say it. There are hundreds of public ports along the inland river system on all rivers in all geographical areas of the country that have hundreds and thousands of acres of green space, totally welcoming you to build your new facility at their location. And inland rivers, ports, and terminals would be just so pleased and tickled to put you in touch with them. So definitely hope that that manufacturing does come back to the United States, and we've got just the spot for you.
And I think it's always going to be, how stable things are. And of course, the states all compete with each other for this type of thing. But I'll say one thing very positive. In the last year alone, I've seen a great deal of interest coming out of the states to redevelop the inland river ports, to develop new port facilities, studies that are being conducted by DOTs and everything about, how do we better utilize our waterways. So they're paying attention to it, which I think is good to see that, which then puts each of the states competing with each other, which is also good, all right, that they're competing with them and they're putting incentives on the table for manufacturing. It just is such a long lead time to get manufacturing done. Look how long it took them, Toyota, to put their plants in, and Hyundai to put their plants in, and everything. It takes a long time to get it built, get it permitted, get it, change the whole logistical chain and everything like that. But you've got facilities that are manufacturing vehicles, along the river system, for foreign-owned companies and stuff. I think the bigger battle is going to be over foreign interests buying into U.S. manufacturers. So, for example, the steel industry in Japan looking to buy U.S. steel and everything like that, which, President Biden nixed. And he nixed it because he says, we're concerned about too much foreign investment coming into U.S. manufacturing. So, but that's part of the world economy, and the reality in all of this is that, the one place everybody fears is China. All right. And Chinese have bought up a lot of property in the United States and everything around the world as well. But I don't think we need to be, xenophobic when it comes to foreign companies investing in our operations in the United States. We have enough controls in place. My thing is, how many new jobs can we create? The world cannot live on a world full of baristas. All right. As much as I admire baristas and love my coffee, the service industry is not the core of what a strong economy is going to look like in the future.
So I want to go back to this new yet returning administration, and I'm going to say towards
Yeah,
the end.
I gotta ask you, returning administration. I assume you're talking about the bureaucratic agencies.
No, I'm talking about President Trump. I mean, it's a new administration, but he's returning.
Oh, okay, I see what you mean. So, all right, he had his apprenticeship back, 4 years ago, and now he's moving into the next spot.
Absolutely.
I think.
Absolutely. So I want to hit on that, and I want to say towards the end of his first administration, he started by executive order, he established a water advisory kind of council committee thing where he was putting in place the foundation and the resources and the experts to provide to him the advice needed for all things water resource related. So I do hope that that comes back. I know that you and I have spoken in the past when times of disaster do strike, call it a high flood, call it a hurricane. Remember back in Puerto Rico, when the devastating hurricane hit Puerto Rico, and FEMA was coming to us as an association saying, we need to get supplies and resources on the ground to Puerto Rico. Could you put us in touch with those that can do it? Well, remember, I want to say it was the terminal operator in Puerto Rico would not allow additional truck drivers. Once it was on the property, they wouldn't allow additional truck drivers. They had to be a part of a thing, whatever. But I'm hoping that with this new yet returning administration, he's going to start that council back up. He's going to accept the experts like yourself in the field that know the who and the how and what they need in order to get the resources. But putting that in place before the disaster hits, I think is very important.
Well, let me comment on that. As first of all, Senator Kelly has filed legislation which enhances the visibility of the maritime industry, and the Democratic senator, I think, and he's a graduate of King's Point, so he understands it, but it needs to be expanded to not only look at the deep water and the blue water stuff, but also the inland river stuff. I think the key is going to be a strong maritime administrator who understands the industry, not somebody who's at the end of their career, right? But basically someone who can be an advocate for the maritime industry, and that has to be expanded into all anything that floats on the water, right? As well as our port industry. One of the biggest disadvantages I see with our maritime schools right now is that, they train people to go to sea, to be boat operators, ship operators. Louisiana Maritime College, which is forming and pulling together and everything like that. It's about always, the deep sea. And we recognize there's a weakness there because we don't have enough people, right? But all that being said, not all of us is going to spend all of our time at sea. There comes a point when, you meet some beautiful girl, you fall in love, or you meet some guy, and if you're a woman like my daughter who went to sea, right? And all of a sudden you want to come ashore. Well, the thing is that built into the maritime education needs to be more about our operating our ports, managing our ports, our inland ports, our waterway, our blue water ports and stuff. That needs to be part of those curriculums. And that's what I think a strong maritime administrator can do, is to be an advocate, right? And so that we get less focused on runways and railways and roadways, and now all of a sudden pay attention to the maritime world.
And not to say that any of our previous maritime administrators weren't focused on that, but you're right, absolutely need somebody with such a strong advocacy mechanism, somebody that understands the way that transportation moves, the routes, the rates, and the emergency response. I think we need to have somebody knowledgeable and an expert in all of those fields. And I can't think of anybody better than my dear friend, Captain Monroe, to be the next maritime administrator. What can I do to make that happen?
I was just going to recommend you because I've told you many times, if you get to the seat of Washington someday, I want to be your driver.
Well, I'm nominating you. Do you have President Trump's number? I need to call him because I think that you would be very well poised and an excellent expert in this field to not only promote the increased use of maritime transportation assets, but the ability to respond appropriately and the knowledge to educate our future.
Well, how about if you be the assistant secretary for or assistant administrator for Inland River Systems?
I could be your right-hand girl.
There you go. I like that whole concept. So It's always
What
nice to dream about the future.
we can be dreamers, my friend.
Absolutely.
What do you have at the association coming up? Any events coming up?
Well, we have, first of all, I'll be doing a mixed course in Tampa, which is kind of a combination of both river and international, the first week of February. And then, of course, we have our AMPE conference, and we have some excellent guest speakers that are coming and being hosted by the Port of Gulfport. And that is the third week of February. All of these are posted on the websites. Got a course in New York coming up, got a course in Baltimore coming up. We're planning another course in Jeffersonville in Indiana, or one of the ports of Indiana, for on the inland side. And the nice thing is that we've got some outstanding faculty. We had a very successful Spanish language program down in Puerto Rico, and we are now in the process of expanding the programs into Australia. All right, so we have one of our faculty members down there who's working with the Australian Maritime College. So I, from our standpoint, we think that there's a lot of good future. There's a whole new generation of young people like yourself, right, who are coming through the market. Oh, come
The
on,
stretch.
right? But I think the reality is that there's always going to be the demand, and I think we've continued to keep a strong focus on the inland river system and making sure that we have good, well-trained people on the inland river system. And I see some mobility, different, there are jobs rolling over, different people going to different places and everything. And whatever we can do to prepare people for that. We're the only ones that do it in the world, as you know.
Yeah. And I do think that we are kind of settling into this year's round of professionals, right? We usually see that kind of shift in professionals going from one place to another in the late fall, early December, in winter time. But here we are, they're settled in. They're pretty much fixed for a good 6, 9 months, hopefully for a long, long time. But at IRPT, we have our spring 2025 round of basin meetings coming up again. We have members all around the nation, and we divide them based on the river they work on, and we call that their basin. So each year we gather all of the members of that particular basin to just kind of discuss some of the challenges that are happening in the basin. Maybe it's river management services. Maybe it's, how do we market our segment of the river system? So we're getting ready to host all of those spring basin meetings. And then we have all of our We Work the Waterways programs. I think we have 12 scheduled right now. We're looking at having a full 16 We Work the Waterways industry interaction days coming up in this spring. We also have our legislative focus, where IRPT's board of directors and legislative committees are hitting the Hill. We're going to meet with our senators and our Congress men and women just to talk about our legislative priorities for the year. So, man, we're gearing up for a very busy season. We love the support of our listeners. So, like, comment, drop a comment, join each organization, plan to come to an event, register to attend either an education session or a basin meeting. Be involved, be engaged, tell your story. And we thank you all so much for listening to our predictions, our pros and cons of the past and the future, and look forward to the next few years.
Well, I'm looking forward to you and I having a good sit down with the Don at
Good
the Oval
Don.
Office and just putting him on the right track.
Sounds good. Thank you, my friend.
All right, and thank you. Always a pleasure, and I always enjoy these programs. And I know we've got a pretty active year planned and stuff like that for new podcasts. And so we'll be working hard to try to get a lot of good information out to the industry.
Thank you.
All right. So from Amy and I, all the very best. Happy New Year to everybody, and we hope it's a very successful and fruitful new year for everybody. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you, sir.